From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Think about any crime story you've seen play out on television. There are plenty to choose from. Jodi Arias, Scott Peterson, Amanda Knox. And think about the judgment you pronounced in any of those cases based on what you saw on TV. He looked guilty. She didn't seem remorseful enough. Look at how he smirked. Look at what she wore. In his documentary, Jeremiah Zagar explores how the media influences the system of justice. And he says it can have a profound effect on the public, on a jury, a defense, a prosecution. Zagar chose as his case study one of the first stories to play out in the media, the 1990 murder trial of Pamela Smart. Next week, we're screening his film. It's called Captivated, The Trials of Pamela Smart. Today, he'll join us to talk about it after the news.
Hey, podcast listener. I'm Benjamin Bombard. I'm one of the producers of Radio West. If you like what you hear on the show, you can lend a hand by giving us a review on iTunes or Stitcher or Facebook. And we'd also really appreciate it if you'd share what you think about the show, or if you have some thoughts about a particular episode, share that stuff around on whatever social media platforms you happen to use. Thanks a bunch and enjoy the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The Pamela Smart story really is the perfect case study to examine the effect of the media on the outcome of a trial. You may remember the story. This was all over the place in 1990. This was in Derry, New Hampshire. Pamela Smart had been accused of plotting her husband's murder with some teenagers, one of which she'd been having an affair with. And it was one of the first full televised trials, if not the first. It played out just as tabloid television was taking hold and when entertainment and journalism were really blending together. Jeremiah Zagar knew of the story, and like pretty much everyone else, he had a perception based on the way Pamela Smart had been portrayed. But when he actually met her, he says she didn't resemble the person he remembered in the media. And Zagar dug into the story, and he's come to this conclusion that an injustice has been committed in Pamela Smart's case. And he points out it's an injustice not just by the system, but he says by all of us. Zagar says we are all complicit, the storytellers, but the watchers too. Next week, we're screening Zagar's film. It's called Captivated, The Trials of Pamela Smart. It's part of our documentary film series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Today in the program, he's joining us to talk about it. Jeremiah Zagar directed the 2008 documentary film In a Dream. His film Captivated, which we're talking about, is going to be screening next Wednesday. We'll give you details more about that as we go along. And he's joining us today from a studio in New York City. Jeremiah Zagar, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I guess I wanted to start with when you started thinking about this story, what got you into this story? Because you've said, you've confessed, you're not really a big fan of true crime or mystery. So what got you started thinking about all this?
Well, I had just finished In a Dream, and we were screening around the country. We actually had wonderful screening experiences in Utah. And I got a call from Lori Cheadle, who is the producer of Captivated. And at the time, I made a living cutting movie trailers. And she said, I have this really interesting movie, and I'd like you to cut the trailer. I heard you're good at it. And she gave me 20 hours or 30 hours of archival footage, and it was the case. It was the case and an interview with Pamela Smart, and I started watching it, and it was fascinating. I mean, really incredible stuff. And when I finished cutting the trailer, I gave it to her, and she said, you know, we love the trailer, and we have enjoyed working with you, and we love your film. Would you be interested in directing the movie? And I told her, that I was fascinated, but that I didn't know, you know, that I wanted to meet Pamela first, that I wouldn't feel comfortable knowing if I could go through with a process that takes, you know, years, unless I knew the subject was on board and I was on board with them. So we went to prison and took all of our money out of our clothing and took our shoes off and our coats and were searched and, you know, went through seven or eight security gates and arrived in a lunchroom where all the women at Bedford Hills meet their visitors. And there was Pam Smart. And she came in and we talked, and she was enigmatic and funny and strange and quirky and totally different from what I imagined from the footage. And I agreed right then and there that this would be a movie worth making.
Did you know at the time what you figured the story was going to be? Because the film kind of is two things. It's this examination of how media coverage influences the way a trial plays out. But it's also your attempt to tell the story that didn't get told in the way the media story was playing out. Did you start out knowing that's where you wanted to go? Did you start out knowing what the film was going to be about?
We knew the media would play a part, but we didn't know how, and we didn't exactly know why. And I think, you know, the exciting thing about making a documentary is the journey you take of discovery, you know, figuring out what the reality of the situation means to you and to the world. And as we looked at those, you know, thousands of hours of archival footage, and as we listened to, you know, the tapes of the jurors, and, you know, as we talked to all those involved with the case, we began to realize that that there was something, you know, very flawed in the retelling of this story, and also something that was pertinent to our society, you know, that I felt like reflected, you know, who we are as people and what we've created. Hmm. And that's, again, what the movie became about.
It's so interesting that you have cut trailers. In the sense that this film is very much about the way, and I'm guessing maybe that's what makes you good, is you can take, through the editing, you can really tell a story. I mean, you can really manipulate a story. You can really change a story. But you must have gotten some particular insights as an editor. Like, oh, I can really make this story say whatever it wants based on the way I use this cut and the way I manipulate this footage.
Yeah, again, you know, I'm not interested in true crime, as you said, and I'm not a mystery person, but I do like procedurals. And I like procedurals because they are, in essence, a process of storytelling. You know, they break down the mystery into storytelling elements, and that I relate to as a storyteller. And as an editor, you're always aware of how easily you can manipulate the story. You know, how if you leave something in or take something out, you can change a person from good or to bad, or from bad to good, or you can leave the nuance in. And I think, you know, that then became my way into this film. You know, what does it mean to tell someone's story? What does that responsibility entail? And then what does it mean when that responsibility is neglected? What does it mean to take someone's story? What does it mean to change someone's story? You know, is that in itself a crime? I think became the focus for me.
Yeah. I want to play an element, a clip from the film. This is a man by the name of Richard Sherwin. He's a law professor at New York Law School. And throughout the film, he really sort of explores, you know, how it is the media can have an impact on something. And in this particular moment, he talks about what he calls the God moment, where he explains how the editing of a story actually impacts the meaning of the message. Let me play this and we can talk about it. This is Richard Sherwin. This is from Jeremiah Zagar's film, Captivated, The Trials of Pamela Smart.
Someone has to put all of that footage together. Someone has to construct the visual narrative. I call it the God moment. The moment when you intervene, you make a cut.
What happened after that?
We had sex.
You shift something.
Why do you think he did it?
I just feel that someone made him do it.
And all of a sudden, you've seriously altered the meaning of that image.
I think the thing that surprised me about the film is just how literally altered it gets by the we'll break down a little bit more of this a little bit later in the program, but just how the energy shifts in the actual meaning of a story based on the way it's told and based on the way people are perceiving the way they're being portrayed, the way they're just the impact of being televised, being watched, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I think also an element that allowed the manipulation of this case to be so rampant was that for the first time, TV was based solely on a system of commerce. So that, you know, these news stations were vying for ratings and they were vying to be profitable. And what they were doing depended primarily upon them gaining those ratings rather than on telling, you know, the fairest, clearest story possible. And because of that, their God moments that they practice in the editing room become based on gaining more viewership and therefore becoming more salacious. And, you know, we see it every day. You know, we see it all the time. We, you know, we watch the news stations, you know, go into somebody's house and film something that they shouldn't be filming or show something that they shouldn't be showing. And we say, well, you know, why are they doing this? But yet, you know, that's what the ratings demand. Unfortunately, you know, for Pamela, this happened before her trial took place.
Right.
And therefore, all this skewed media coverage was, you know, permeating every household in New Hampshire, you know, before the jury was even picked.
You had to have been thinking about this particular story when, what was it, CNN and NBC and all of these news organizations went clamoring into the apartment of that couple
right.
in San Bernardino. I mean, that's, I guess you don't have to go very far to find stories like this. Examples.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, part of what's interesting about looking back at this case, though it takes place 20 years ago, over 20 years ago, yeah. is that it's happening all the time. I mean, it's happening constantly, you know, from trials, but simply, you know, to everyday news stories. I mean, you know, why do we show Trayvon Martin in a hoodie? Mm-hmm. You know, why does the news do that? You know, what's the point? You know, what's the point of creating these stereotypes of people? You know, what's the point of making them simpler and easier to consume? And I think it's a problem. It's a big problem.
Yeah. Let me play another clip because this is what's so interesting about the film for me. Are there numerous times in here where people say things that with no irony whatsoever that seem really crazy and really outrageous. Here's an example. This is Bill Spencer. Bill Spencer was kind of – well, he was a television reporter for the local station, WMUR. And you get a sense he's kind of into sensational stories. And he – maybe set this up for us. Tell us who Bill Spencer is, because he grabs hold of the story and really makes it his own.
Yeah, well, the story was just a local news story. And Bill Spencer, who was a local reporter and very dogged, was the first person to interview Pamela Smart and tried very hard to get that interview. And when he did, he went after it. In, you know, the way that we describe, in a way that would entice viewers to continue watching as much as possible. And that was his job. You know, again, Bill Spencer considers himself a storyteller. And I think that's what's interesting. You know, it's like, you know, I relate to Bill. You know, I relate to all these people who do these kind of, you know, salacious acts because you're trying to make sure that people watch your story. And Bill had been looking for a story that that could explode his career. And his boss was demanding that he find a story like that. And so when he did, he ran with it.
Well, and it's funny, though. It's like he doesn't have any self-awareness at moments. And or either that, or he's just really brutally honest about the fact that, hey, I'm in this for the sensational part of. Well, let me play this clip. Well, yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I don't want to.
Well, I just think you have to keep in mind that until this film, nobody thought of the conduct that had taken place during this time as being prurient or wrong.
Right.
You know, it was, you know, in a way, he's, you know, he considers himself a hero to some extent.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And all the people involved in Pam's incarceration feel that way because history has, you know, deemed it so. And I think, you know, part of what we're trying to do in the film is to re-examine history. You know, it's not, it can't always be told by the winners.
Right.
If it is, you know, you get people like Bill Spencer thinking what they did was right.
Well, he goes on national television, like at the Donahue Show, and Geraldo arguing with Pamela's family before the trial. And he produces this big, I don't know, what was it, an hour-long film that went on the air 2 days before the jurors were going to be selected, which seems crazy.
Yeah.
But here's Bill Spencer from Jeremiah Zagar's film.
You cover a murder case and you try to dig and dig and find out as much as you can, but nobody really ever knows the whole story until the case goes to trial and people under oath start telling what happens. In this case, I've managed to tell everybody everything about this case before it even goes to trial. I mean, the whole thing is out there.
WMUR-TV presents the Gregory Smart murder case.
There's no irony in him saying that.
No.
It's crazy. Like,
yeah,
why do we even need to try this thing?
You know,
I've told everyone the story.
Right. Do you know that's wrong? Do you know that's shocking? And, you know, I think he does it. I think and I think for him, it felt like, you know, he was breaking the story. He was discovering what the cops should have discovered. You know, for him, he was playing detective, and actually what he was doing was desecrating the justice system, you know,
exactly.
But like that's, that to him wasn't the reality.
But I guess the question is that a kind of quaint thing from the beginning of reality television in the 90s, or in 2015, is this also a reality that people are still
thinking?
Yeah, I mean,
I think it happens. I think it happens all the time. I mean, I think people are proud to have, you know, more and more and more. I think people are proud to have, you know, said whatever they're saying on television or in the news before it actually has the time to be verified. And I mean, I think it's a problem with the news. I think, you know, it's a problem with our politicians. You know, a lot of times when I would when I was cutting this movie, I was thinking this is so much like politics. You know, our politics are so much more Bill Spencer, you know, than they are the decent, you know, clear-minded reporters of, you know, yesterday.
Yeah.
They are speaking untruths, and, you know, they demand that that we listen to them, and, you know, they're not held accountable. And I think, you know, it's funny, you know, we don't hold all these people that determine our lives accountable, you know, the people in the media and you know, the people who represent us politically. And I think, you know, if anything, this film is an attempt to demand or to hope that that, you know, we as audience begin to question what we're being fed.
You know, it's interesting, the film, there's that part where there's the broader story about how the media sort of processes all of this. But I don't know if you're familiar with the podcast Serial. But there's
for sure
absolutely that element in this too, which is just a way of saying you should come see it next Wednesday because it's a really gripping crime story, and you'll be absolutely captivated by that part. I like that twist on the title as well, right? I mean,
And again, what I loved about Serial was that procedural aspect. And
yeah,
we wanted very much to achieve that with the film. We wanted to take you step by step through how it happened. And, you know, show you the different sides and allow you to make up your mind.
Jeremiah Zegar is with us. He directed the documentary film Captivated, The Trials of Pamela Smart. We're going to be screening it next Wednesday night at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. It's part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Jeremiah is going to join us for a Q&A after the film, so you should be with us. Seating is limited, as always, so we advise you to arrive early. We have details for all of this on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're continuing our documentary film series with a story that explores how the media machine influences the justice process. The filmmaker Jeremiah Zegar is with us. He wanted to take a story and kind of break it down, see how the cameras and the television coverage influence a real crime story. His choice was kind of perfect. Pamela Smart's case, this was from 1990, Smart accused of plotting her husband's murder, and it had lots of salacious details. It became the first fully televised court case. But Zegar says the Smart that he met didn't resemble the Smart portrayed on TV. The film is called Captivated, The Trials of Pamela Smart. We're going to be screening it next Wednesday, and we'll give you details about that as we go along. Jeremiah Zegar is joining us from a studio in New York City. I want to talk to you about the dramatic element of this. And you write about, or you explain in the film about the various ways in which this story was dramatized. And one of them was in a novel. This is another weird part of the story, I have to say. Joyce Maynard, who wrote this book, she's in your film. And she writes this book called To Die For. And she's influenced, of course, by the Pamela Smart story that she is watching play out on television. And let me play this clip from the film, and we can talk a little bit about it because I think it's really interesting.
I picked up the newspaper, and there she was on the cover, I think with handcuffs on, this, you know, the cheerleader with handcuffs on. And that's when I knew. I had decided I'm going to write a novel. It was very much the fact of having seen her on television before in this other role, the grieving widow role. Very pretty, young, blonde, former cheerleader, you know, the kind of girl that I would have really been hated but secretly envied, you know. And the recognition that, in fact, it was rotten, something very ugly behind it that bore no relationship to the image in front.
So Maynard saw it not as a— this is so interesting. It's almost like she has a hard time distinguishing the real story from the fake story she created, because it's like she doesn't see the real story happening to a real person. She's seeing an archetype of the beautiful woman brought down, and that's kind of how she's conceiving it. Would you talk a little bit about that part? 'Cause I thought this was such a fascinating part of the film.
Yeah, well, again, I mean, I think Joyce Maynard is a wonderful writer and a beautiful artist. And, you know, one of the things artists do is they appropriate. You know, they appropriate the world and filter it through their own lenses. And I think when she saw Pam on screen, in a way, she saw the worst of herself. Hmm. You know, this person that she would have hated, you know, that she wouldn't have wanted to be, but secretly envied. You know, it's like this, it's very much about her. And instead of trying to discover who Pam was, she let her imagination run wild, and she wrote, you know, a best-selling novel. And I think what we as artists, especially as documentary makers, need to think about now, again, Joyce is not a documentary maker, but we as documentaries need to, you know, makers need to think about is how are we responsible to our subjects?
Yeah.
And, you know, people who are influenced by, you know, by the media and, you know, by its portrayal of, you know, the real people involved, and who use those real people as fodder for their work, you know, how are they then responsible if their work affects those people's lives? And I think that's a question that as artists, we are rarely asked to confront, but it's a question that's very important that we do confront, because I think it plays to our basics, ethical foundations of our work. And and I think, you know, Joyce has been grappling that with that. You know, recently she came out and said publicly that Pam should be let out of prison. You know, and I think that was a bold thing to do.
Yeah. There's a really telling moment when she kind of misspeaks. And she says, the character that she's created, by the way, which she has crafted as this sociopath who doesn't have a soul, her name is Suzanne Moretto. But when Joyce is talking about the character that she creates, she accidentally calls her Pamela in the film. Am I making too much of that? I thought that was really interesting. She sort of
misspeaks. I think that's I think that's real. I think she confuses them, and you know, it's unclear to her when she gets worked up. I mean, who's who? And you know what's the truth as well is that it became unclear to the world, you know, and we didn't get to interview Gus Van Sant, but his film very much dictated the way people viewed Pamela Smart and still view her. You know, there's a line that we didn't use in the film where one of the reporters, I think it was Tammy Plyler, she says, you know, if you ask people in New Hampshire, young people who Paul McCartney is, they won't know. But if you ask them who Pamela Smart is, they can tell you how much they hate her. And, you know, I think that is extremely telling about how much that book and that movie played into the public consciousness there and defined who she was. And, you know, it very much gave us, Laurie, the producer, and I, a reason to make the film, because there was a crime, you know, that was committed that Pamela Smart didn't get a fair trial. But for Pamela Smart and for me, I think there's a greater crime in that her story was stolen from her. Mm-hmm. And, you know, something we kept coming back to is, you know, there's that scene at the end of The Crucible where John Proctor, you know, is asked to lie, you know, to say what he's supposed to say so that so that he can live. And he says, I can't, you know, I can't do it. And they say, why can't you do it? You know, you're going to save your own skin. And he says, you know, because it's my name, because it's my name and because I have no other and that's all that I have. And, you know, he yells it. And, you know, Pam Smart has been doing that for years, you know, for years. She's been saying, you know, I can't admit my guilt because it's my name, because it's my story and because it's the truth of who I am. And you know, what we wanted to do with this film primarily, more than anything, is to give her that story back, you know, to show this a side that is not what is in the public consciousness, to show a side that's much more nuanced, that's much more gray, and I believe, you know, much more quote-unquote true.
Yeah. Here's Pamela Smart talking about that, as you said, and the movie, the Van Sant movie, is To Die For, with Nicole Kidman, a great performance, and it's an amazing film in a lot of ways. But people say to Pamela in prison when they, hey, I've seen your movie. Like, I've seen your story. I know who you are based on that fictionalized account of Joyce Maynard, you know, via Gus Van Sant in this film. Here's her reaction from Jeremiah Zagar's film.
Pamela Smart is cold, flighty, and airhead, and manipulative, calculating, self-centered, tantalizing. People say, oh, that's you. Or, oh, I saw your movie. And it's like, this is not my movie. Nothing in here is my story. It's not. It's just their interpretation of what happened. And these are the kinds of things that help prevent me from getting back into court.
Did you get a sense that that this movie, and there's a really I get a sense it's a pretty crappy TV movie with Helen Hunt. I don't know. Surely you saw it, right? I mean, you went back and watched it.
Yeah, I've seen it. Yeah, absolutely.
It's a CBS TV movie. What influence do you think that actually had on Pamela Smart's attempt to get, you know, a retrial, to get a hearing again?
Well, I think just, you know, it's systematically, especially, you know, it came out and it was big in New Hampshire. I mean, I think it got huge ratings. But, you know, it's slowly but surely, you know, all the media, it was sort of like, you know, just a stepping stone or another brick. But it just began to reshape, you know, her story and the narrative. You know, this is what the audience wants to see. You know, this is a classic trope. You know, this is Eve, you know, this is the Scarlet Letter. You know, there is a desire to pin a crime on a young, beautiful white woman. You know, that is for some reason, you know, a desire of our, you know, Puritan foundations as a country, I think, and maybe, you know, as a human culture. She was much more appealing as that Black Widow character. And, you know, the people we talk to throughout the film, you know, are able to more eloquently address that, you know, through historical texts that support it. But, you know, I think it becomes clear, you know, simply in how relevant the story became around the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's, you know, murders happen every day, but why this murder? Yeah. You know, why was this so deeply ingrained in our society? And you know, it had to do with, you know, sex, and it had to do with, you know, a slightly older woman and a younger man. You know, it was lascivious and enjoyable for an audience to demonize her. Yeah. And therefore she was. And so, you know, little by little she became demonized.
There's an interesting style element in the film where we see some of the people you talk to. And in the sort of the foreground, we see some of those images of the coverage from 1990. Did you actually ask some of the people to go back and watch these images to get a kind of sense of it, a reaction to it?
Yeah, actually, you know, in a way, that's one of the coolest things we did technically. There was a guy named Mr. Wang who had built a screen in Texas that you could project images through, so that would lay on the screen and also carry through in a transparent way. And we wanted very much to have a see-through television that we could see the reactions of our subjects and also see the footage, so that they could, you know, you could watch them jogging their own memory. Luckily Mr. Wang had just invented this contraption, and Gabriel Sedgwick, one of our producers, he found it and, you know, had it shipped up, and we made a point of showing every single subject that we interviewed a series of clips from that time, so that they could revisit those moments. And some of their reactions we show on screen, but some of them we don't. And some of them simply play into the fact that by watching this footage, they were able to revisit that moment more viscerally. Mm-hmm. And it supported the thesis of our film, which was, you know, not a film about events, but a film about watchers.
Right.
And it was interesting to watch the watchers watch.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, let me play a clip from Paul Thaler. He's this journalism professor at Adelphi University. And he talks about how the actual energy of an event is transformed because people are being observed. Did I get that right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, well, let me have Paul. He explains it much better than I do. We can talk about it from Jeremiah Zagar's film, Captivated, The Trials of Pamela Smart.
Cameras, by looking at the courtroom environment, changes the nature of that courtroom environment. Werner Heisenberg, quantum physicist, studied microscopic particles, and he realized that those particles changed form in some sort of way by injecting energy into that system. And he comes up with this Heisenberg principle. It was an observation that the act of observing a physical entity changes by the act of that observation. The people are different as a result of being observed. There's a self-consciousness, in other words, that goes on by being part of a television event.
So congratulations, you got quantum physics into your film too.
Yeah, I mean, not just me. Keiko Deguchi is one of the best documentary editors out there, who cut the film, you know, was very instrumental in making those things that seem a little bit dry, relevant, and you know, I felt like it was very important. It's, you know, although it's not a new idea, it is important in terms of understanding the events of this trial, and I think in terms of basic media literacy. Mm-hmm. And you know, we wanted to make a film that that young people could watch too. You know, that mm-hmm. Young people could watch and be then aware of, you know, how their media manipulates them, and I think that's really important physically how it does it.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Jeremiah Zagar is with us, directed the documentary film Captivated: The Trials of Pamela Smart. We're going to be screening it next Wednesday night, where we usually do, at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center at 7 o'clock. It's part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Jeremiah is going to be with us for a Q&A after the film, so you should join us. Remember, though, seating is limited, and so you should get there early. We have details about all of it on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the filmmaker Jeremiah Zagar. We're talking about his film Captivated, The Trials of Pamela Smart, which we're going to be screening next week. Jeremiah will join us for a Q&A after the film. We have details about that on our website. We'll give you a little bit more about that later. Well, so with this conversation about media and the influence as prologue, you really dig in this in the film to really kind of create a more honest, clear portrait of what happened, really going through and breaking down the story. Would you talk about that part? Because this can't be easy.
Yeah, well, we had a a crew of, I think, 5 people researching for 2 years, going through, you know, all the trial transcripts, every piece of archival that existed on the subject, which is a lot, and then breaking it down and, you know, synthesizing, you know, what had and hadn't been seen. And I don't think it's too much to give away that one of the things we found is a juror who will remain unnamed recording her thoughts about the trial day by day in the bathtub and at night.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I think those tapes are the most illuminating thing, because you really see the process of justice working from the inside and how different it was from the way it wasn't working on the outside.
Yeah. Let's hear a little bit of that. This is juror number 13.
So we drove Barry right into the condominium. It was nasty and rainy and cold. And half of us went into the Smart's condominium. About Pamela Smart, what did I feel about her today? She looked tiny, troubled. Just can't even imagine what she must be feeling.
How did you get that tape? Can you say?
I can't actually tell you. Mm-hmm. I think I'm legally not allowed to tell you. But dogged work. I think, you know, once you start exploring a story, what you realize is that, you know, there's often a lot more there than you could have imagined in the beginning. And finding those tapes were incredibly exciting.
Yeah.
You know, I think, you know, once we had those tapes, we realized that there was an arc to the trial that hadn't been told yet, and that there was a reason to revisit the trial step by step. And, you know, again, it became much more of a 12 Angry Men,
yeah,
you know, than you know, than an Alfred Hitchcock movie.
I think we're doing a pretty good job of not giving too much away, which is good, because I don't want to. We should explain, I guess, some of the particulars and some of the complicating factors that Pamela Smart has to encounter. The witnesses themselves, obviously her extramarital affair that was going on with this young boy, Billy Flynn, who's, you know, the question of what exactly happened. There was this tape. One of her student interns, Cecilia Pierce is her name, basically wears a wire and talks to her. That's another element of the story. I mean, all these kind of complicating factors. Again, I don't want to give too much away, but that she has to encounter a lot of problems with the case. There are a lot of problems that you have to kind of work through.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, what is so fascinating about the case once you go through it bit by bit, piece by piece, is that there is no clear innocence or guilt, that it's a much more murky decision, you know, and...
it's just like being bummed about the end of Serial.
Right.
Right. Don't you
right.
think? It's the same yeah. thing. Like, oh, come on. Give me a clear, tidy end. And I don't want to give too much away. I won't. But it's that same feeling, which I like, which is to say things are more complicated than that, folks, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and I think, you know, that our brain, you know, it hates nuance, I think. You know, it's like yeah. Somebody was telling me the other day that, you know, when we walk down the street, our brain creates a picture of what our peripheral vision should be. Mm-hmm. You know, the things that we can't see, our brain is saying, oh, well, this is what's there. Mm-hmm. Even though, you know, it's not necessarily true. And I think, you know, that's why stories that tell us exactly what's there make it easy on us and easier to consume. And we didn't want to make something that was easy on the audience or easy to consume. We wanted to make something that was much more real, you know, that and much more murky and much more gray. Now, I think what our justice system does say, though, for these very gray situations is that when it's gray, you know, rather than take someone's life, you do the opposite. Mm-hmm. You know, you set mm-hmm. them free. And I think what happened in this case is that it was really gray, and despite that, she got put away forever. You know, and there's an interesting – This guy, William Hurst, you know what? Actually, it wasn't William Hurst. It was another expert, and I'm going to forget his name right now, that we interviewed that didn't make the film. But one of the things he talked about was the way a jury swings. So when a jury is split in a deliberation room, you know, when they are right down the middle for guilty and not guilty, if you give them enough time – 90% of the time, they'll swing towards guilty.
Wow.
And, you know, that has to do with the way peer pressure operates in terms of human nature. And it's depressing when you think of it in terms of justice. And that's very much what happened in this case. The expert was Scott Sunby.
Just came to you. The question of eyewitness testimony and how that works comes into play. And I won't say exactly how, but this idea of how it can be transformed, how it can – this is how the person you use in the film mentions this. It can decay. Would you say a little bit about that? Because I thought that was an interesting element of this. The fact, and I think we all know this at this point. You can't really trust. You can only trust to a certain degree eyewitness testimony because things are, our brains are malleable.
Oh my God, it's so fascinating. I mean, this is another piece that I could give your audience that didn't make the movie because it's such a long explanation. But and this was William Hurst who told me this story. Mm-hmm. But they did the first large scale test on memory and trauma after 9/11. And they took a swath of 100 people who had just experienced the events of 9/11, and they asked them simple questions. You know, where were you? Who were you with? What did you see? And then a year later, they asked them those same questions. And over 50% of the people had changed their story. They were in a different place. They were with different people. They saw different things. And when the interviewers asked them to look again at what they had said a year prior, they said, oh, I must have misremembered then. You know, that they were now so sure of what their memory was that they were unwilling to admit that they had changed it. And, you know, we do that consistently, and the media plays an enormous part of that. You know, you see things on TV replayed over and over again, you can change your perception of where you were when they actually happened and how they happened.
Yeah. Let me play another clip from the film. Richard Sherwin, again, he's the law professor featured in the film. He's talking about whether the system is up to the task of finding the truth. You know, can it even now in this era? It's worse now. Media coverage and, you know, all of the different options that are out there. Can it really find the truth in a process that has been so influenced, you know, and so processed by the media? Here's Richard Sherman.
The founder of Court TV once said that trials are the most dramatic narrative that we have outside of violent combat. The idea is multiple perspectives will generate multiple stories, and in the test, that is the cauldron of the adversarial process, truth will be victorious. But what happens when we're so taken with the media's distillation of the story? Is the adversarial system up to that task?
What do you think?
I think it's not. You know, and the Supreme Court has actually said that it's not over and over again. You know, they kind of say, you know, if the media has permeated the airwaves with its point of view, there is no ability to achieve justice. I think if you watch this movie, you can see that that's true. You know, the Supreme Court asks that you abate the trial until it's no longer part of the public consciousness. But despite that ruling, you know, trial after trial after trial is held, you know, after the media has played the arguments out for itself.
So what are you asking for if you are in particular, you know, reform or some limits on television coverage? I mean, what do you even, what could you even do about that?
Well, I'm not a policymaker,
yeah.
And I'm not even really an activist, but I am a person who would very much like our society to question the images they are fed more often.
Yeah,
you know, I'm a person who feels that we are a society who is undereducated and illiterate about the forms of information that are given to us, and that we need to become a society that is more filled with questions and less in need of answers and solutions. Mm-hmm. You know, we need to be grappling with these issues, especially when life and death is on the line, and it's on the line much more often than we realize. You know, we need to be thinking, much more about our system of government, our justice systems, you know, our media systems than we are.
Yeah. We have about a minute left. Let me ask you this finally. One woman in the film, Joyce Chopra, she's the one who directed that CBS TV movie of the Pamela Smart story. She admits in your film that she exploited Pamela Smart, but then she turns it around on you, which I loved. And she said, as you are doing, about 30 seconds left. Was she right? Did you? I guess you copped to that too in some way.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to a certain extent, we are. I mean, and that's a feeling that that I think every writer and filmmaker and journalist, radio producer, you know, must relate to. You know, because you are an accomplice. You know, you are in need of something, and you're doing it for your own needs to a certain extent. And I think despite that, you have to feel that what you're doing is for a reason, you know, that despite the fact that you're doing it, you're ideally doing it for a greater good.
Jeremiah Zegar. He directed the documentary film Captivated, The Trials of Pamela Smart, which we're screening next Wednesday night at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. Jeremiah will be with us for a Q&A after the film. You can get the details on radiowest.kuer.org. Jeremiah, we'll see you next Wednesday. Thanks very much.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.